Breakfast at Sally's by Richard Lemieux. Chapter 12. Another Day in Paradise. She was new at Sally's. When I arrived at 8 a.m., she sat motionless at the round table farthest from the door, her face buried in her hands, her strawberry blonde hair a mess. Four plastic bags packed to the brim were at her feet, and two small notebooks were lying on the table. This was no professional bag lady. Her purse was Gucci, her clothes were fashionable, albeit wrinkled, and her Reeboks were a gleaming white. I got a bowl of cream of wheat, two jelly donuts, and a cup of coffee and found a seat. It was Friday. I saw a newspaper in a trash can in the corner. It was Wednesday's New York Times. Good enough, I thought. For some reason, I couldn't help looking at her. I could see the anguish of this lady. In the months of starting each day at Sally's between 8 and 8:30, I had seen many things, the drug-crazed, the schizos, the bipolars, and the drunks. But this was dark, really dark. I could see and feel the big black cloud of depression hovering in the sky, blocking out every ray of sunlight. I knew that feeling. At times like that, I felt as if I was drowning. Just below the surface, I knew something was up there. It was life, but I didn't care. And I knew she didn't care. She knew her future. She would live out the lyrics of the Phil Collins song, Another Day in Paradise, calling for help, but never being heard. One of the black guys, Alan, came strolling in and walked her way. He touched her gently on the shoulder, and she slowly raised her head. "You've got to eat, Karen," he coaxed. "You'll feel better." The woman shook her head. She closed her eyes and laid her head back down on the table. Alan, a slim man with a small goatee, placed his hand on his chin and rubbed his whiskers in a moment of contemplation. He tried again, politely tapping her on the shoulder. When she raised her head this time, he bent at the waist, cocked his head, and smiled. "Please eat with me. I don't like to eat alone. I'll get something for you," he said. "Okay," she murmured. Alan lied. AP, that's what his friends called him, seldom ate. He usually drank his meals. He liked vodka best, but he'd settle for Night Train Express fortified wine for lunch and dinner. He was a happy drunk. He also was a super salesman. It was hard to say no to AP. AP called the four-block radius around the Salvation Army building home. He roamed the area each day, panhandling in his special way. He'd stop a person along the street and tell him a joke or compliment him on his coat, hat, or tie. And then he would always ask for 87 cents. "I need 87 cents, just 87 cents," he would say. Hell, his jokes were worth 87 cents. "I learned it in Los Angeles," he said of his trick. "They always give you a dollar. No one is going to count out 87 cents," he added, laughing. AP talked with his hands, waving and pointing to emphasize each word, and after years of refining his routine, he had it down. It usually ended with a palm extended and a smile on his etched face. When he got enough money for a fifth of vodka, he would stop for some, quote, lunch, unquote. AP was 54 years old and lived with two other gentlemen behind Sally's. They would roll out their sleeping bags at night and pass out under a stairwell that led to the basement of the building. They caused no harm, committed no fouls, and were on a first-name basis with the police who cruised the alleys at night. After years of experience, the cops were happy the men were there. They would report it if the really bad guys showed up. AP never ventured more than four blocks in any direction from Sally's, especially north toward the Manette Bridge. 4 years ago, just past 11th Street, he told four young men a joke and then asked for 87 cents. They beat him nearly to death. He was helicoptered to University Medical Center in Seattle and spent a month in bed. While he was there, the doctors ran some tests and discovered he had colon cancer. They gave him 2 years to live. AP walked out of the hospital and hasn't seen a doctor since that day. Late one Friday night, the boys were drinking and smoking in the alley and listening to some tunes on an old radio they found in a dumpster when Karen showed up. It was 1 a.m. She was hungry and tired from her several-mile walk. She had been evicted from her home in Paulsbo. AP gave her half of the bologna and cheese sandwich he had left from Wednesday's sack lunch at Sally's. He tried to cheer her up with a few of his jokes and even shared his night train express. Like the gentleman he was, he even gave her his sleeping bag to get her through the night. This man, who was supposed to be dead by now, this man who had given up dreaming, hoping, planning for the future, this man had worried about this woman. He instinctively knew that she had two roads to choose between. One was long and could take her to a new life in the sun. The other was very short and very dark. He got her a bowl of hot cereal, some orange juice, and a cup of coffee and returned to the table. "Here, this is for you. I'll be right back. Want some cream? I'll tell you a joke after I get mine," he said. Then he quickly grabbed 2 jelly donuts and some cereal for himself and hurried back to the table. Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and Bill Clinton went to see The Wizard of Oz, AP began. "What do you want of the great and powerful wizard?" the wizard bellowed. "Well, Mr. Wizard, I've been forgetting a lot of things lately, and, well, I thought, if possible, well, could I get a new brain?" Reagan asked. "And what do you want?" the wizard roared, looking at George H.W. Bush. "I've got to tell you, wizard, when that lying Bill Clinton beat me in the election, it broke my heart. I need a new heart." "And you, Bill Clinton, what do you want?" the wizard thundered. Bill replied, "Where's Dorothy?" AP belly laughed and slapped his hand to his leg. Karen smiled wanly. James, one of AP's, quote, roommates, unquote, came in, poured himself a cup of Java, grabbed a donut, took a bite, and headed for my table. "The Mariners lost again, man, 4-1, he said of Oakland's win over Seattle. "They're a game and a half back now. They're going to do just like last year. Lead all year long and then fizzle out at the end." "Doesn't look promising," I said. "Their pitching looks tired, and nobody seems to be able to get a hit with runners on base." My eyes glanced over to AP and Karen. James noticed. He leaned toward me. "That lady is having a bad time. A real bad time, man," he whispered. "Got put out on the street by the sheriff yesterday. An eviction. They put her stuff on the curb, man. On the curb. In Paulsbo. No one helped her, man. No one. What's all that about?" She was now in her first day, her first hours of being homeless. "What's that like, man, to, you know, lose everything?" James asked. "Somebody told me you were rich, boats and stuff, and lost it all. I never had anything to lose." "She's in shock right now," I said. "I don't know her story, but she's wondering why the angels didn't come over and save her, why God deserted her, why nobody cares." Her nerve endings tingle. Everything seems fuzzy. It's like a bad dream that will go away as soon as she wakes up. She wonders where her friends are and why they aren't helping. She wonders why all the people who said they loved her are not trying to help her. She feels hopeless, totally hopeless. I took a drink of my coffee. "She has no bed, no pillows, no pots and pans, no television, no refrigerator, no closet to hang her pretty clothes in, no clean socks, no cherished mementos or pictures of loved ones sitting on the tables or hanging on the walls, no table or chairs, no candles or incense, no flowers. No place of her own, no true privacy. All the things that made her Karen are gone. I don't know her story, but I have been right where she is, and it's going to be tough. very tough for her to make it. My mind flashed back to my own eviction. I had fought to stop that memory. "Please, let's not go back there," I whispered urgently to myself and buried my head in my hands. But I could not win this battle with my mind. Not at this moment, in this place. I remembered being in the courtroom before Judge McCluskey. Sitting on his throne in his black robe, he had evicted three other families before me that day. I thought, this poor man has a miserable job, putting people on the street. I wouldn't be able to sleep at night if I were him. The notice was on my door by 4 p.m. that day. I remembered curling up in the corner of my living room that night before my eviction, covered by a blanket and holding Willow in my arms, hoping the world would change overnight and people would be kinder to each other. I remembered my son-in-law's father, who came to see me be evicted that day. He said, "I don't feel sorry for you." I wondered, how could anyone not feel sorry for a person being evicted, tossed out in the street? I would feel sorry for anyone experiencing that. And I remembered pulling out of the driveway of my home with my dog in the van, with no place to go. If the lady across the room had any of these feelings I had had, she wasn't going to make it past this day. No one where she came from cared. Only AP cared at this point, and he was a total stranger to her and her world. Karen now had her hands spread out before her on the table, and I could see the chipped red nail polish and the gold band on her finger. She probably paints her toes too, I thought to myself. I bet she looks pretty good when she's all gussied up. "Look, man," James said, "she's still wearing a wedding ring." I continued to look at her hands, and her ring on her face. Karen's eyes met mine as she looked across the room. I feared she knew we were talking about her. I wanted to rush to her, to try to save her, but I could not. I had no magic wand. She looked away from me for a moment and then looked back again. Her gaze lingered. She was talking to me with her eyes. "You know, don't you?" they asked. "You've been here like me, haven't you? But you can't help me, can you?" Then she looked away. I saw something in her eyes I didn't have. Courage. Resolve. I knew what she was going to do. She had already decided. She was accustomed to having things. Nice clean clothes, perfume, cream for her face, and feather pillows. She had grown to enjoy and to expect instant gratification. Now all she owned were the clothes on her back and the few things she could carry in plastic bags. The bankers, the masters of credit, had taken everything else from her just for a few more dollars in their accounts. The rich had to be protected, you know, so they can buy another house or another boat or another cruise. It's the American way to throw people out on the street. "I wish the major were here," I said anxiously. "He might be able to help her. But someone said he is out collecting food today." "What we need, man, is a SWAT team," said James. "Yeah, a SWAT team, for goodness. Good guys jumping off the roof with ropes and busting in the door to help her. That's what we need right now, mister." I kept scanning the room for C. Maybe he could help her with a poem or something. But he wasn't in sight either. "I'm going out for a smoke," James said, pushing away from the table. "I'll go with you," I said. We cleared our trays like schoolboys and headed outside into the drizzle that had just begun to fall. "Let's see, who do the M's play now?" I asked. "They have Oakland again tonight, and then they come home for two against Anaheim, I think. They need to start winning, man, or it's over." While we were talking baseball, Karen came out the door. AP was right behind her. "Where are you going, Karen?" AP asked. "Why don't you just hang out here a while? Heck, it's raining and you don't have a coat." Karen kept walking, empty-handed, in the rain, through the pay parking lot that adjoined Sally's. "I'll be back," AP said to James, and he rushed to catch up with her. She was now half a block away. By the time they had reached 8th Street, AP was pleading, "Come on, girl, please don't cry. Let's go back before we get soaked in this rain." "I'm going back," he said, stomping his feet on the pavement. Karen kept walking. AP rushed again to her side. "Look, baby, we can get some money. James and me can. You can get a room at a motel. We can make things better for you. Let's go back." But there was no going back for Karen. At 10th Street, AP stopped. He had gone his four blocks, the end of his safety zone. "Where are you going?" he yelled as she crossed the street that turned right toward the Manette Bridge. "What are you going to do?" AP rushed back to Sally's to get help. There were just three blocks remaining before Karen would reach the bridge. By the time AP got back to Sally's and we drove to the bridge, we knew she was gone. Cars were already stopped on the bridge with people peering over the worn rail. We could hear the sirens from police cars in the distance. They retrieved her body 2 hours later. At dusk, I found AP sitting on the crumbling cement steps by the walled-off back entrance to Sally's with a fresh bottle of Night Train Express. He was wiping tears away with his shirt sleeve. James and Lionel were there, too, but no one was talking. AP wasn't telling any jokes. "I'm sorry," I said, knowing no words could soothe the pain, and then I turned and walked away. "Hey, Richard," AP called out. I turned and walked back, and he handed me a small paper sack. "I don't know what to do with these. I can't just throw them in the dumpster. Maybe you know what to do with them." I opened the bag and took out a small plastic makeup case with a cracked lid, a lipstick holder, and two small notebooks. "She left them on the table," AP said. One notebook had a Monet flower design on the cover. I opened it. The first page had been torn out. On the second page, she had written, "Watch, penlight, cat, bracelet to little Joe." On the third page began a poem. "The winter here is cold and bitter. It's chill ass to the bone, and I haven't seen the sun for weeks too long, too far from home. I feel like I'm sinking, and I claw for solid ground. I'm pulled down by the undertow. I never thought I could feel this low. Oh, death, darkness, I feel like letting go. All of the strength and all of the courage comes to lift me from this place." 3 pages later, she wrote, "Today I choose to love, not hate, forgive, not accuse, lay down my life for them who don't believe anyone cares, not return evil with evil. Put Satan to rest by not allowing them to be the opposite of what they really are. Not let their walls block my view of their soul. Be a friend to all." The other notebook was handmade from a notepad from the Navy Federal Credit Union with the words "worth noting" in gray letters at the top of each page. The pages were stained by something spilled on them. On the second page, she began, "She took her life within her hands. She took within her two hands. No one can tell her now. I believed in you. Underneath this canopy of snow, where 57 winters took their toll, I believed in you. Where did you go? I believed in you. Where did you go? Gone to meet her, back from where she came. Make her gone to save her soul. Come to me. She took her life in her own two hands. Angel, fly over me, my angel. Come, it's late and past your bedtime. I will keep you safe forever. I will keep you safe. Angel, my angel." After a minute or so, I looked at AP, James, and Lionel and asked if they wanted to say a prayer for the lady. They all nodded. We joined hands in the gravel parking lot and said, "Dear God, please help Karen find peace in your gracious and loving home. Amen." Then I asked AP, "Could you spare a glass of that Night Train Express?" "I don't have no glass, but you can have a swig or two," he replied and handed me the bottle. I found a seat on one of the old blue plastic milk crates and shared the bottle with AP, and he started telling me a joke. Colin Powell, Norman Schwarzkopf, and George Bush were captured by the Iraqis, he began. They took Powell before the firing squad. As AP was telling his joke, my mind returned to the night I had attempted to end my life like Karen had. I wondered how it must have felt, falling through the air, knowing death was just seconds away. I wondered how she felt in that final moment when all she ever knew, thinking, breathing, talking, walking, living, was leaving her body. I wondered if she was now in hell in the hands of the devil, like all the preachers warn. Was the evil one chuckling, "I've got you now. You are going to get what you deserve, you homeless, worthless scum"? Or perhaps she was in heaven, where Jesus himself would be towing her off and consoling her as she cried, "I couldn't stand it anymore. It's terrible down there." And Jesus would reply, "I know, Karen. I know." That's tonight's episode. At this point, we must break off our reading. You've been hearing Breakfast at Sally's by Richard Lemieux. Copyright 2009. It is read with the permission of Skyhorse Publishing of New York. Join us next time on the bookshelf for Breakfast at Sally's. The bookshelf is produced and edited by Vern Windham. I'm Jeff Hazen.